Oops, pardon me. It's really a pleasure to be here. Again, my name is Richard Cannings. I work for Google. I've been working at Google for about 4 years now, and started working on the Android team back in August of 2007, 2 years ago. Previously, I was part of the Google security team, where I protected or helped with the security of many both client and web applications that Google provides. But now I solely kind of work on the Android team, mostly because I've come to this realization that security is not necessarily a checkbox that you kind of check off before launch, but it's kind of an ongoing process that you have to vigilantly kind of maintain throughout the whole entire life of a project. If you haven't noticed yet, I'm quite nervous, but also flattered and excited to speak here today. And I'd really like to thank Fabian, Dan Bonnet, and all the USENIX Security Program Committee for inviting me here today. So how about I start off with a little motivation of why we should care about mobile security. I'm sure you all, here's kind of the overview of what I'll talk about. First talk about a little motivation, talk a little bit about Android itself, and then dive into the security of Android. So why do we care about mobile security? I bet all of you already care about mobile security. I know a few of you have written papers on mobile security already. But just to motivate the naysayers, currently there's almost 7 billion people in the world. There's about 1.5 billion internet-enabled PCs, many of them Windows PCs. There's over 4 billion mobile phones. These are both traditional mobile phones, mostly traditional mobile phones, and smartphones. But people buy phones regularly. In fact, it's a huge e-waste problem, or it's an emerging e-waste problem. People tend to replace their phones between 1 year and 1.5 years. And people buy 1.1 billion phones a year. About 13% of these phones are smartphones, internet-enabled smartphones. And soon the number of smartphones will compare with the number of internet-enabled smartphones will compare with the number of internet-enabled PCs. And these smartphone OSs will become a major security target. Personally, I think that this will become an epiphany to malware authors and attackers, and they'll someday realize that wow, like there's a huge market share of let's say iPhone OS, hopefully Android OS, possibly Symbian OS, and they will then focus their attacks on mobile phones to steal user data and also profit directly from mobile phone attacks, such as by installing dialers or installing applications that will send premium SMSs. So I care about mobile security very much, and I hope you do too. So what is Android? Well, we say Android is a free, open source mobile platform that any handset manufacturer or hobbyist can install and any developer can use. Android supports both native development and Java development. And we call it a platform and not necessarily an operating system because along with the Android operating system, we have a full featured Java software development kit, including a full emulator, Eclipse plugins, and various native and Java debuggers. And the idea of Android is to truly empower users and developers. So all of you can like write applications for Android, and all of you can make Android more secure. Android is not just designed for mobile phones. It's designed for set-top boxes, car navigation systems, and other internet-aware enabled devices. Currently, Android is running on phones carried by 32 different carriers over 21 countries. And we expect there to be about 18 Android devices by the end of 2009 on the market. So let's talk a little about the technology. Well, Android, like many other Linux distributions, are based on a Linux kernel. And on top of that Linux kernel, Android has all the kind of usual suspects of open source Linux distribution libraries, right? We have a WebKit-based browser integrated into Android. We use SQLite for data storage, OpenSSL and Bouncy Castle for security libraries. Our libc is called Bionic, and it's based off of the OpenBSD implementation of libc. We use Apache Harmony for extensive Java libraries, and Apache HTTP client, most notably for HTTP requests. Our API supports many common sound and video image codecs. Our big media codec library is called OpenCore, originally developed by Packet Video, and Packet Video decided to open source OpenCore along with Android. We also have API support for Bluetooth, Edge, 3G, Wi-Fi, camera, video, GPS, accelerometers, compasses, vibrators, sound, you name it. It's actually very interesting because typical desktop computers don't have such elaborate features. And now that we're empowering users with all these features, imagine what sort of security applications you can create using all these IOs. Talking about what you can create, how about we talk a little bit about Android development? I'm going to give you guys a very simple overview of Android development. I encourage you to go to developer.android.com to get more information about Android development. But here are kind of the fundamental objects that we use for developing Android applications. It is definitely different than your typical Java application. One object that is very key to Android development is an activity. An activity is essentially one user endeavor or task. So this screenshot is an activity. It's a visual task that the user is presented with. This is an inbox. Actually, this is the public Android security mailing list. And this activity is part of a greater email application, which is composed of many activities. And this activity is just simply scrolling through your inbox to choose what email you wish to view. Then we have services. Services is essentially a Java daemon, and it runs for an indefinite time in the background. So you could think of maybe an activity could be, let's say, the GUI for your MP3 player, where you can press play, skip forward to the next song, etc., while the service in the background is the actual application that is streaming the MP3. Finally, we have this concept of intents. This is not a new concept. Actually, nothing that we've done, I claim, is new. I just think they're kind of incrementally kind of novel applications of old ideas. Intents is an asynchronous messaging system. I consider it very similar to URL handling. Essentially, what you can do is you fire an intent to switch from one activity to another. Those two activities may be in the same application, or they may go from one application to another. So how about I give a brief example? Here is an example email application. The email application is composed of many activities, an inbox activity to see what just came in, your compose activity so you can write your email, and a viewer activity. If one were to touch on one of the messages within their inbox, it would then fire an intent, and that intent would then swap the viewable activity to the viewer activity, where you could actually read the email. Part of an email application, you assume, would have other background processes running, such as an email fetching service. Again, this is a greatly simplified version of Android development, but it gives you kind of the feel of how things interact. One thing that the mobile development team became aware of really quickly was that developers don't understand battery life. We're taught in school about conserving space. We're taught in school about conserving time, right? Consider computational complexity, log space, or polynomial time, right? But no one ever really considers how can we conserve battery life. And this is extremely, or at least power in general. And this is extremely important in both the very small scale, such as mobile devices, and the very large scale, such as large data centers. Power is the ultimate constrained resource in these two environments. So users are very cognizant of battery life. They, in fact, make purchasing decisions based off of battery life. So we really wanted to make sure that the device would conserve battery life, and we wanted to make it transparent to developers. We wanted to make it easy for developers to conserve battery life. So how we do that is we run various activities. So here's a here I am playing a song, and as we, if I decide to, like, let's say, switch to a different application, say like view an email, the activities kind of stay on, with, on the stack. And as I continue to look at more, to investigate, all these previous activities are still running resonant in memory. But at some point, I may launch another activity that will consume so much resources that it'll kill background activities. So here my MP3 player, let's say, gets killed as I look at some of my GPS tracks. Of course, the MP3 player UI is killed and not necessarily the service behind, which is actually running the playing the MP3s. So essentially, it's designed to protect battery life. And one of the really interesting unintended features is that it also helps with denial of service attacks, because developers now don't have to worry about their applications being killed all the time. We store state in the background so that we can applications can be restarted without really the user experiencing the application dying at all. One thing to note is that that the most foreground activity is never killed. It's always present, and the system does its best to generate resources to in order for the most foreground activity to stay alive. So once you develop these applications, where do you put them? Well, you can put them on the internet. We Android, not by default, but if you change a setting, you can download an Android package, an APK package containing an application from any website, or you can attach it on email and install it. You can throw it in an SD card and install it. But we find it very difficult for developers to connect to users that way. And so we created Android Market, which is essentially a Darwinian environment that we designed to allow for good applications to excel while bad applications are forgotten. We have about 5,000 applications on Market right now. And Market is our strike at a balance between openness and security. Other marketplaces are designed to be walled gardens, where applications cannot be instantly uploaded, but they are then reviewed by some form of a gatekeeper who will analyze the application in order to deem if this is safe to go within the walled garden or if it's not allowed. We decided not to go that route because we wanted developers to be able to upload their application without anyone stopping them from doing so. This is part of our kind of open metaphor and our open platform. Unfortunately, this opens us up to malware, right? We have no way of stopping applications, bad applications, from going up into Marketplace. We need actually, I'll talk about malware later on within the talk when I get more deep into security. Application developers also have to use cryptography. They have to sign their applications. We tried to make this very simple as well. We didn't want to. By design, we decided that all the certificates would be self-signed certificates. Developers would not have to go to a central certificate authority to get someone to pay somebody to tell them who they are. So every application has to be signed by the developer. The application is not intended to be a general form of identity. It's really intended to ensure that during the update process, if developer A created application A, only developer A can update application A. And that's the design between the cryptography. And we decided to use common, or at least existing, tools in order to perform this cryptography. And our tools, what we recommend the tools to use is Java's key tool and jar signer. So I went very quickly through just Android's overview, and I kind of want to spend a little bit more time on the security of Android. So I had this once-in-a-lifetime privilege to design a security framework for a brand new platform. And I was really living this fantasy until I recognized that we had a few constraints. The biggest constraint that I was faced with was that we had finite time and resources to perform this. We had millions of devices being manufactured, being stockpiled in warehouses. And we had to ship these devices about 10 months ago, last October or last November. We had to ship these devices within a certain time frame. If we missed that time frame, those devices were going to be useless. The technology will become quickly antiquated, and we'd have nothing. So we were forced, so everybody was on a very, very strict schedule, not just the developers, but also the security team as well. I had that problem, and then also I kind of realized through my experiences at Google that humans have a very difficult time understanding risk. It's safer to assume that most developers do not understand security at all, and that most users do not understand security at all either. Of course, this is a safe assumption and not necessarily the truth. But for instance, with respect to developers understanding security, I know of no school that requires students to take a course in safe programming. And I'd love it if you guys could help me solve this problem. I think that I would love to see, say, a data structures book in a first or second year computer science course actually talk about a safe programming within the context of, let's say, data structures. Also, with respect to humans not understanding security, or at least users not understanding security, we needed to create a solution that both developers and users will use, a security solution, so they won't ignore the security features. And also, we want those security features to not impede with the users performing their intended tasks. So the ideal is that we make security features both mandatory and transparent. So we based our every security decision and every security design choice off of three philosophies. First, we wanted to prevent breaches from occurring. It's a very traditional sense of security, like don't have security problems. Right, pardon me, let me get some water. Next, we wanted to minimize security issues. So right now, if you install malware on your desktop computer, that malware will have access to all your user data and also your browser. And we wanted to somehow minimize that impact. Then we wanted to find new and novel ways to detect vulnerabilities. And of course, we needed to react to vulnerabilities. We knew we would not find all vulnerabilities in a system. Systems are too complex these days to be perfectly secure. So let's talk a little bit about prevention. This is kind of the traditional focus area of security. So just some metrics here. Android uses almost 100 open source libraries. As we mentioned, WebKit, OpenSSL, PCRE. Right? I can just pontificate on the lists. Also, over 3.5 years, we added 5 million lines of new code. So, our big barrier was, well, not a big barrier, but and something that I'm proud about, is that Android was open source, so we could not rely on obscurity at all. So what I did is I teamed up with various security experts from the Google security team, ISEC partners, and Enruns to help me secure Android. We couldn't do it all, so we had to triage. So what were we going to look at first? We essentially concentrated on high-risk areas. We needed to prevent remote attacks. We needed to secure drivers. We needed to secure media codecs. And we needed to secure our new and custom features. New and custom features are so new, like since they're new, they're not well vetted and they haven't matured. Other efforts we did in prevention was we tried to add low effort and high yield exploit mitigation features, right? Simply put, SSL is an exploit mitigation feature for man-in-the-middle attacks. So we tried to use SSL whenever necessary. However, we were really cognizant of battery life, and every time we turned on a new stream to use SSL, we had to we had to analyze the impact on battery. Two coworkers of mine, Neil Mehta and Peter Valchev, they added properly stack protection to prevent stack-based overflows. This is actually a first on the ARM architecture. And we ran into some nasty GCC bugs. GCC was not able, did not correctly implement ProPolice on ARM. And these guys definitely had to learn a lot about compilers in order to get ProPolice working. We also added some heap overflow protections. For instance, we added chunk consolidation protections in DLmalloc, which is a solution that was originally incorporated into DLmalloc by the OpenBSD people. Sadly, we couldn't put everything we wanted into Android due to the time and resource constraints. The security features that are most notably missing on Android are stack and heap non-execute protections, and also address space layout randomization. With respect to ASLR, address space layout randomization, we quickly realized this was going to be a huge performance impact. We couldn't afford, or at least users couldn't afford, for us to install different images on every single device in the factory. We had to install identical images on the factory. But at the same time, pre-linking libraries was extremely important for speed and battery life. There's also issues with respect to ASLR and Android's zygote process. Zygote process is the process that is used for spawning new applications in Android. I personally consider a low overhead ASLR implementation to be an open problem right now. And I'd love to hear you guys' input on how we could make, implement ASLR, or actually more importantly, prevent return to libc attacks on mobile devices without impacting battery life. So let me get into detail of one of our preventative measures. This is DLmalloc. So Dugly's malloc is used in, I believe, all implementations of GNU libc. It has a little problem. It stores all of its metadata in band with the data, which means that all that metadata is kind of subject to corruption. What people do is they have this attack called heap consolidation attacks, where if they find a heap overflow, they can overwrite pointers to forward and previous unconsolidated chunks. And rewriting these two pointers is more than enough to perform remote code execution. So we decided that a small code change, just to check the integrity of the heap chunk information, to make sure that B forward back is equal to B, and B back forward is equal to B. And we believe that this small code change would make greatly increase the complexity of writing a heap overflow. This was a defense in depth measure, right? First, we need to prevent heap overflows as best as possible. And secondly, we want to prevent easy ways to exploit such an issue. So I could kind of continue to kind of pontificate about all these great security features we've added into Android, but I believe that talking about our failures are far more interesting and educational than talking about our successes. So one failure we had is we unfortunately shipped with a heap overflow. Charlie Miller made this heap overflow famous when he used it to break into both Mac OS X to win the Pwn2Own contest, and also to break into the iPhone OS to jailbreak it. And last October, Charlie Miller and John Herring from Flexilis found this PCRE issue, or sorry, this WebKit issue, greater WebKit issue, in Android. So we try hard to keep our almost 100 open source libraries up to date, but we had to roll back WebKit at the last minute because of usability issues, and we did not apply security patches. Quickly, John Herring and Charlie Miller found this issue and notified us. They sent us a crasher. Essentially, crasher bug just shows that they can crash the application, and hopefully, if you look at the stack trace and the registers, it will give you enough information to believe that this thing is exploitable or not. However, when we when we pulled up, when we looked at the crasher and pulled up our binaries in IDA, we recognized that it was crashing on a segv, a segmentation fault, but it was crashing on the segmentation fault of our heap malloc checks. In fact, it was crashing on one of these conditions when it was actually trying to execute that pointer or try and access that pointer. So we thought that we were safe. We thought we were good, right? Well, not quite. Due to the way WebKit allocates memory, an attacker could use heap feng shui, a technique originally developed by Alex Sodorov, to groom or adjust memory without dealing with DL malloc at all and be able to adjust already allocated memory in order to execute code. Interestingly enough, Alex is speaking in a couple, actually I think he's speaking tomorrow about state-of-the-art exploit mitigation techniques. And I think it's a very a worthy talk to go to. I'll definitely be there. So our attempt for preventing these exploits, preventing these kind of generic heap overflows worked kind of to some degree, right? We increased the difficulty to exploit this issue to some degree, and hopefully we sent these would-be attackers to find lower hanging fruit on other platforms. Just as a side note or follow-up to this, we fixed this promptly too. We fixed this within about 8 days from when we were notified. But it's kind of naive to think that prevention is all it takes. Like, we never wondered if WebKit would have a security issue. We just knew they're in there. We knew that there was going to be problems in WebKit. We knew there was going to be problems in the Linux kernel. We even knew there was going to be problems in Android code that we wrote ourselves, right? So we just assumed that security issues would happen. As systems become more and more complex, it becomes more and more probable that security issues will occur in operating systems. And essentially, we cannot rely on prevention alone. No one can say, "Oh, this system is unbreakable." Right? There's no such thing as a full-featured unbreakable system. We just have to recognize that vulnerabilities happen. Right? We can't ignore that. And even if we were to have some mythical unbreakable operating system, users will still install malware, right? And third-party code is still going to be buggy, right? So how can we minimize the impact of stability and security issues, right? So with my web security background, I look to web security to help me out. I recognize that if my email web app has a bunch of security vulnerabilities, it does not affect the security of my banking application. So even if my email app has like tons of cross-site scripting, cross-site request forgery, you name it, web application vulnerabilities, it will not impact the security of my other applications. So why do the rules change when I download applications and run them in the clients? Why does it happen when I download malware? Malware has access to all my personal data. It has access to my browser, including the browser memory. So it has access to the passwords I type into it. It has access to the cookies that I'm sending. It has access to my banking information. It has access to all the other information on my computer. Web security, it's because web security is based on this idea of the same origin policy, where in a simplified view, let's say we have one web application per domain name. And that web application can only speak back to the domain where it came from. It cannot speak to other domains. So our idea was, let's extend this web security model to the operating system. Traditional operating system security is host-based. This is a very easy abstraction to think about. Perimeter protection, right? My computer is secured because it's in my house and I have locked doors. I have secured the host, right? And so when you think about computer security, it's great to think about in an abstract way, let's secure the computer from data. But that's not how computers are used these days, right? We allow people into our computers all the time. When I go visit Facebook, I allow Facebook to come into my computer and execute code on my computer, right? When I even go to Facebook, I let those ads come into my computer and execute code on my computer. And we don't know, I don't know if I should, I do trust Facebook, but I'm not sure if I should trust those ads. I don't even know if Facebook knows what ads they're serving. So it's equivalent to physical security as we have this perimeter protection, but we're always opening the door and letting these people come into our rooms. And they're letting us come into probably our most insecure room, which is our web browser. Because web browsers are extremely complex. They parse so much data that there's bound to be a security issue in one of those data parsers within a browser. Also, traditional operating systems focus on user separation, or at least traditionally focused on user separation. Back in the day, when everyone was having multiple users log into Big Iron, we'd have many users, and they'd have to kind of protect a user from each other. But mobile OSs are for single users. So we don't need user separation in a mobile operating system. They're intended for a single user. So we kind of looked at what user separation does. And user separation is very similar to a same user policy, if we were to consider it like the same as the same origin policy. User separation is like a same user policy. And if we were to run each application within its own UID, that would be like a same application policy. And that really gives residence into kind of extending the web security model of the same origin policy to the operating system. Let's run each application in its own UID. This is not a new idea, right? I think this was originally developed by Solar Designer, this concept of privilege separation. And so we decided to implement this user separation. Unfortunately, user separation is actually rather difficult to develop. I wouldn't consider it easy. So we wanted to make it very simple for developers to implement. In fact, we wanted to make it as transparent as possible. So that's where we created the application sandbox. The application sandbox is essentially a default privilege separation model, where each application runs within its own UID and its own virtual machine. So here's here's a diagram of a few applications running within Linux. We have the Linux kernel at the bottom, then we have a system process, which performs key gluing of applications together. Each application runs within its own Dalvik virtual machine. Dalvik virtual machine is like a Java virtual machine, except it only requires about a 71K memory footprint. And we run each virtual machine within its own UID. And so the browser will run in the virtual machine under, let's say, UID 0, while the phone will run in the virtual machine of, like, let's say, UID 3. And actually, when I say UID, I mean user. I wouldn't actually run anything as UID 0. Correction there. That would be rude. So each application runs within its own UID. So that gave us like instant security features, right? It gave us instant resource sharing between applications. It gave us instant CPU protection, memory protection. We got amazing data protection from this via Unix file systems. And also we were just given for free an authenticated inter-process communication model, which is called Unix domain sockets. So the default Linux applications had too much power, right? Generally what I like to think about is I like to protect user data, and I also like to protect the network, because attackers use the network to perform like distributed denial of service attacks, click bots, spamming, right? There's all kinds of ways to abuse network connectivity. So we decided to lock down these the access controls to create a default minimal access kind of application. So we decided to use Pac-Man, or essentially any game, as kind of the foundation of what minimal access would be. So we said, okay, well, what does Pac-Man require? Well, Pac-Man does not require internet. So let's lock down the internet from default Linux applications. We did this by changing the kernel and using group IDs, GIDs, as the access controls. So if a GID, if an application had the internet GID, it would access, it would be able to access the internet. If it did not have the internet GID, it would not be able to access the internet. We also locked down other features such as Bluetooth access and a few other controls, microphone, right, speakers. And we created this kind of like minimal kind of security control. So we wouldn't really have to rely on users to make security decisions. So, but that kind of impedes innovation, right? We need a way to allow people to access the internet. We need a way to allow third-party applications to access people's content, or sorry, contacts within a browser, or within a phone, right? We need a way for developers to innovate really new and interesting programs using all the data, right? So we created this whitelist model. First, as I mentioned, we locked down the applications to its bare minimum, where we think that still we'd actually have useful applications within this bare minimum infrastructure. Then we'd allow for user-accepted access, or user-accepted access to these resources. But we didn't want to ask the users very often because, as I said, one of our assumptions was, or one of our safe assumptions, was that users do not understand security. So we had to ask them as little as possible. We decided to ask them at install time. We also made all of our security questions based off of, made it understandable to users. Even when you turn on Android debugging, so this is a developer feature within the phone to debug your applications, we still present Android debugger to the end user, and we essentially say, we don't recommend you using this, right? We don't want to present the questions to the developers because developers know what ADB is and they know how to use it. The end user are the people who need to be educated. So we tried to make them as simple as possible. Currently we have 194 permissions on Android, right? Some protect the internet, some protect access to the camera's flash, right? Personally, I think this is way too many permissions right now, right? Security researchers always want more granularity in security. But as we add more granularity, we add more complexity. And it quickly kind of just confuses the users into complacency and acceptance. So to be honest, I think less permissions is actually more secure because it'll be more understandable to the users, and the users will be able to make educated decisions on what security controls they want applications to access. Here's an example of our one of those permission checks. When you install, let's say this. Hello? Oh, there we go. Okay. When you install one of these Twitter applications, before you install, it'll say, hey, we want network communication. What does that mean? They'll access full internet, right? This Twitter application also wants to be able to get your GPS locations and be able to take photos, right? And so the user's only asked at one point at install time for this access. So we took privilege separation and just tried to use it as much as possible. This is our kind of privilege separation as our main solution for minimizing exploits, right? One example is with OpenCore. That is our media codec library, right? I personally believe that media codecs are probably the most insecure pieces of code that is written today. It's not because of the complexity, It's not because of the developers, right? I think some of the media codec developers are some of the sharpest developers out there. But it's because of the complexity. Being able to write a working media codec is hard enough. Being able to secure it is even harder. And being able to write a fast media codec on a resource-limited device, such as a mobile platform, is even harder. And those security checks slow things down. So we tried our best to secure OpenCore as best as possible, but we knew we were not going to find every single security issue. So what we did is we banished it to to another user ID. So we created this media server process, which would then parse all of the media that's coming in, and the media server process would have limited access, right? It would be able to write to the display so it could show videos, and it would be able to access the sound card so it could make sounds. But that is it. That is all we allowed it to do. And this solution actually immediately paid off. Last February, Charlie Miller reported a vulnerability in MP3 parsing, and he sent us a crasher. He claimed that that he could use this to control the browser, right? And but the crasher crashed in the media server process, right? The crasher was also so if it were to be exploitable, it would have only been it would have only had access to the media server, the media server UID. It would not be able to access the browser's cookies. It would not be able to access the user's emails. It would only be able to manipulate and listen to some audio and video streaming that was happening at the moment. Interestingly enough, too, it was a crasher in the Huffman decoding. So he had to write shell code in such a way that that when the MP3 was decoded, it would then actually have the shell code, which would be quite a challenge. He wouldn't be able to rely on manipulating, let's say if you downloaded this MP3 from the browser, how I would attack this, because I don't think I'd be able to write shell code from a Huffman table. I would use, again, Alex Sodorov's methods of heap grooming and create an environment with JavaScript where I'll be able to manipulate or insert shell code, and then I'd jump to that that area. However, the browser is running a separate UID than the media server. So just like in your regular Linux desktop, you cannot access your friend's memory. So heap grooming, it would make it much more difficult to actually perform an exploit, because he wouldn't be able to use heap grooming through JavaScript in order to set up memory to execute it. So our next philosophy is detection, right? Like, even though Charlie Miller's report could have manipulated MP3s, listened to sounds, and changed the video, it's still a security issue, right? Even though it's a lesser impact, it's still a security issue. And we need to detect these issues. How we did so is we decided to engage as many people as possible, right? We have a lot of very sharp developers on the Android team, and we decided to educate these developers to show them how people find and abuse their code. It was funny because the first times we started finding security issues, in Android code, I was working with mobile developers who are not really, I guess they're not really accustomed to security people. And a few of them IM'd me late at night, fearing that they were going to get fired because I found a security issue. And so we kind of quickly realized that these developers think we're adversaries, and we're not. We're really trying to help them. So we tried to make it as fun as possible to find security issues. We tried to really encourage people hacking their friends' code within Google, and especially during code reviews, so that we can make it more secure. We also performed like extensive design reviews, because if people understand the security problems that they're going to come across in the future, they can kind of design and work around it. We performed code audits, line by line reading code, also fuzzing, and this was done by the Google security team, ISEC partners, and NRUNs. We also used some honeypot technology. I had an intern, Sid Stam, who created a honeypot tool called Droid Lab, where he runs, where he has all these virtualized Android devices, and he can run all these applications in market on these virtualized Android devices to see if they perform anything malicious. So, also, our philosophy was that that we believe that everyone wants security. So even though we try our hardest to secure Android, we want to allow everybody to detect security issues, right? We want to allow users to detect security issues, right? Which is a bit of a challenge because, like, what if you were to find malware right now on Windows? Who would you guys notify, right? Like, would you notify Microsoft? Would you notify Sophos, right? And you guys are the security experts. So imagine what, like, my mom would do if she found malware. What would she do, right? We wanted to engage developers, right? I mean this in the most flattering way, but I like to think of developers as security monkeys because they exercise so much code that that if we get enough developers clacking on their keyboards, they will eventually find every security issue in Android. And I like to think that they probably write a few works of Shakespeare along the way. And one thing that I've been really excited about is that developers find some very, very interesting design issues because they stumble upon these design issues quicker than security researchers because it takes a little bit more time for the security researchers to understand the platform, right? But security research are extremely helpful. I love them, right? The things that most security researchers are doing on Android right now is they're applying their fuzzers to Android, and they've been finding some very, very interesting results. Security researchers are awesome because we get this top talent looking at our code, and we're getting it for free. And we do want like everybody to kind of engage with Android security because it is like an open source platform, and the idea is to get everyone involved. So I'd like to actually give some shout outs to some of the researchers who have shown us some very interesting techniques. My favorite is actually Patrick William and Machigar from Penn State, and they applied formal methods to access the SMS and dialer. And it's very interesting because I remember reading papers in grad school about formal methods, and I thought, this is completely theoretical. It's never going to have any interesting application. And then I get this other fat paper, and I'm like, oh, another fat paper on formal methods. And then I get proof of concept code. I was like, wow, that's pretty impressive. So we quickly fixed those before launch. Also, I'd like to thank Charlie Miller and John Herring for notifying us of the WebKit issue, the WebKit heap overflow issue. One great forum for mobile security is this forum called XDA Developers. They're a bunch of mobile phone hackers, mostly just playing for fun. They're not necessarily security researchers. They're just very, very curious developers. And on XDA Developers, they found this really interesting trick of being able to reboot into safe mode and being able to bypass our lock screen. Again, Charlie Miller and Colin Mulliner have recently found some very interesting and significant results in both MP3 fuzzing and SMS fuzzing. And finally, I'd like to thank Panasonic and Chris Palmer for finding some recent permission regressions on Android. And if you guys ever find security issues, I greatly appreciate it if you could email security@android. Security is really important to us, so if you send just send us whatever you can. Proof of concepts is appreciated, and if you cannot give us any more, then we'll kind of fill in the blanks. We always treat security reports as a symptom to a greater problem. So once one person reports a security issue, we kick off a security audit to find similar problems within the platform. Also, user reporting. So users have a central place to download applications, so we decided to use Marketplace to be a central place for reporting security issues as well. Here's kind of an example. If you believe that that this Twitter app is malicious, you can go and flag it as inappropriate. And if you mark it as harmful to the phone or data, we'll actually start an investigation to see if it's an issue. In fact, our first user report was this report for MemoryUp. MemoryUp is a mobile RAM optimizer. They claim to make your device faster, more stable, more responsive, and provide you with less waiting time. And this was not exactly true. I said it was the first application that was flagged as malware. And I had the luxury of disassembling and reversing this application. There's actually 5 versions of it that were on Marketplace. All were taken down by various terms of services abuse. To reverse engineer this, I used a tool called Dex Dump. Dex is our version of compiled Java files, like a class file for Java. It's for a Dalvik executable. And so if you guys ever want to try reverse engineering any of these things, just go download open source Android at source.android.com, build it, and you'll have this great little tool to start playing with Dex files. So as I kind of looked through memory up, I realized it has all these pretty progress bars, right? And I love progress bars, right? There's nothing, if I'm really down, what I tend to do, this is like one of my in the closet things, is I tend to love doing fresh installs of Linux operating systems. There's some great feeling of installing like OpenBSD on my Socrates box or installing Linux again on a nice fresh install. It's great. So I can appreciate pretty status bars because that's pretty much all I do it for. but apparently that's all that memory up did. Right, memory up, all it did was essentially show beautiful UI, well, kind of nice UI, progress bars, I like that, and it created large strings, and then it ran the garbage collector, right? Of course that's going to free memory, right? But it only freed memory within its own virtual machine, right? Remember, every application is running within its own virtual machine. If this was the foreground process, and it would generate more and bigger strings, to conserve battery life, we start killing background activities, right? We save the state, kill them. So, in fact, if you were to use memory up, it would free lots of memory. It would show, oh, you're getting tons of memory freed because it just freed a huge string and it's killing all your background processes. But it doesn't make your device more responsive or give you less waiting time. It actually increases the waiting time because now when you switch over to those applications, they have to restart from scratch. They're no longer resident memory. So we wound up concluding that this was not malware, and it was essentially not much at all. So we removed it from market for violating yet another term of service. So prevention and detection and minimization only gets us so far, right? Reacting to security issues swiftly is our final cornerstone. And I personally believe that auto-updaters and reacting to security issues or just through auto-updaters, is the greatest security feature since Diffie-Hellman, right? I believe that auto-updaters should be a required feature for all modern operating systems. They should, and auto-updaters should not just update the operating system, they should not just update themselves, but we should also provide a centralized facility for third-party applications to all be updated. And we have, our process is called OTA, over-the-air update. And user interaction is optional. If you download a new update of Android, it'll ask you if you want to install a new update. That's how we do it typically, but if it necessitates, we can force users to install new updates. The over-the-air update does not require any additional computer or cable, right? So I believe that in many countries, and even in Canada and the United States, many people buy telephones and they don't have desktop computers. In developing countries, most people believe that many users in developing countries are gonna leapfrog the experience of the internet on a computer, and they're gonna experience the internet for the first time on their mobile phones. So we have to be able to update these devices without a cable, without another computer, because we want to update as many users as possible. So with our over-the-air update, we're very lucky to have a very high update rate. However, the over-the-air update is only one step to a much larger process of updating devices, right? I'm mumbling. I'm almost saying right a lot. I've just been catching myself. Updating on mobile phones is extremely difficult because every single carrier is concerned about a mass failure during updates. And we currently have 32 carriers. Every single carrier requires approval before we perform those updates. And Android is still a very small operating system in comparison to, let's say, has small acceptance compared to BlackBerry, Symbian, or the iPhone. The other concern is, when do we roll out fixes? Do we roll out the fix at the first carrier approval? Right? That will put all the other carriers or all the other users on different carriers at risk. Do we wait for the last carrier to approve before we update everybody? And what about updating open source Android? Right? When are we going to update that in relation to updating our users? So in order to kind of explain the complexities of reacting and auto-updating, let me explain our recent shared UID regression. Shared UID is a permission within Android, and it's this feature that we use to help developers create more interactive applications. So we came up with this idea. In fact, it's stolen from the National Rifle Association. And we believe that malware do not hurt users. Malware authors hurt users. So what we do is we allow two applications that are signed by the same developer key to share the same UID. This allows a lot more interactivity. Now we can run both applications within the same VM so we can preserve memory. But unfortunately, there was a code change in Android, in a recent code change in Android that commented out that check. And Panasonic quickly reported that our shared UID, that our shared UID permission was broken. So if a user was to install malware on the device, the malware could share a UID with an existing application installed on the device, such as the browser. So the malware would be able to access all the browser's memory, cookies, passwords inputted into the browser. On a desktop operating system, this is an accepted result of a person installing malware. But on Android, we consider this to be a security issue. And again, as I mentioned, this was a regression. So what do we do? We were first notified on May 14th. The issue was easy to fix. It was a simple comment out. We created a patch, and what we decided to do is we recognized that maybe we have other regressions within permissions. So we started to kick off an internal audit to find more issues. We built about 38 flavors of Android. Essentially, we have one build per carrier and device pair. Then we coordinated a public response with both the original reporters, the carriers, PR, and we use OCERT, a computer emergency response team, to help us deal with the advisory. So they will hopefully provide an unbiased opinion of what the attack is. Then we sat and waited for carrier approval, and we continued to do more internal testing. And we continued to audit for more permission issues. On May 21st, we received critical mass approval, and we started to roll out the fixes. We OTA'd the users, we rolled out the patches to the factory, we patched the SDK, and we patched open source Android. We also had OCERT release the advisory at the same time. This was performed in 8 days and involved literally hundreds of people across companies around the world. And you think it's over, right? Well, not quite. We continued to audit our 194 permissions, and we wrote regression tests to ensure that these permissions would not be broken in the future. We completed this audit in early July, and then again started the whole routine again. We coordinated public response with the carriers, PR, and OCERT. Once we received critical mass approval, then we started to roll out the OTAs to users. We sent out new fixes to the factories. We updated the SDK, open source Android, and we released the advisory. our greatest challenges here were mostly political challenges and not technical challenges, right? We have to try to get mobile carriers to accept these patches as soon as possible. But mobile carriers are rightfully timid to accept patches. They don't want us to roll out a mass update that will break everybody's phone. They can't handle the customer calls. They don't want the customer dissatisfaction. But this is a big challenge for us to do, to make OTAs as quick as possible. And we consider it to be very hard, but it's very important to us, and we know it's very important to our users. So our goal is to make over-the-air update on mobile devices as quick and as broad and update as many users as possible as desktop operating systems today or desktop applications today. So now we've kind of come full circle. After the OTA, the system is in better position to prevent and minimize problems than the previous versions, right? And the cycle restarts. These security processes of prevention, minimization, and detection are not checkboxes. These will continue and will continue to make continue to prevent better because it is the key way to secure systems. We'll continue to work on minimization because minimization tactics like privilege separation and the same origin policy need to be constantly improved to confront the new situations. The more people who detect security issues, the better, right? We all want a secure platform and work together, and together we'll be able to find more of them. And I definitely thank everybody who has found security issues on this open source platform. And finally, we recognize that we're not going to find all security issues. So reacting to security issues quickly is a necessity. And our OTA system is striving to make updates quick and seamless on mobile platforms. So thank you very much.
So I think we have time for just a few questions, and if you can just walk up to the mic, quickly state your name, one question per person, and take it from there. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi there. Yeah, so we minimize the number of root-owned processes. Ping is one root-owned process, and our zygote process, which spawns all the other processes, is the only other root process. So our tactic to minimize privilege escalation was to minimize the number of applications that run as root, but also then you have kernel issues, right? Drivers, and anything in the kernel, there is no such thing as user separation in the kernel. The interesting thing with the application sandbox is it's a new security tool, but at the same time, it's relying on previous security solutions. So it's relying on a mature security model. So we believe that there's been extensive investigation into privilege escalation within the Linux kernel, and we're going to continue to work on removing security issues in the Linux kernel and update any publicly known issues in the Linux kernel to prevent privilege escalation. But I agree that, like, it's interesting because privilege escalation was never thought of a really, like, cool exploit, right? Everyone wants these remote code executions. But we've kind of made privilege escalation kind of cool again for hackers, I guess you could say. Yeah.
Okay, back. Hey.
Yeah, Ben Zorn, Microsoft Research. So I had a question. Are you looking at using hardware protection for execution, basically execute prevent bit?
Yeah, the execute never bit on ARM.
Yeah.
So that's where we're investigating that.
Okay.
With PT GNU stack, with that PT GNU stack control. Yeah.
Okay. And the other question was, other than the buffer overflows in the heap, are you looking at ways to mitigate dangling pointer errors?
Sorry, dangling pointer
errors.
That's a good question. We're not looking at that exploit per se. We're looking mostly our next main focus area is the pairing of non-execute and address-based layout randomization to prevent the return to libc attacks.
Thanks.
Yeah. On a type-safe language, most of it. So we try really hard to write as much in Java. The motivations is not just for security, but also for portability. We want people to run these on netbooks. There's like an open source project right now to run it on an EPC. And we don't want developers to have to worry about compatibility between different platforms. Recently, most notably, one of the issues we had was the SMS issue. The SMS issue that Colin Mulliner, I think he talked about it yesterday or the day before, and Charlie Miller found. On our code base, we had a Java exception and not a segv. We had essentially an array out of bounds exception rather than a segmentation fault, which provided with some security. It wasn't exploitable for remote code execution, but still there was definitely issues with the denial of service attacks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, Marcel Simon from Metco. How do you deal with developers requesting a maximal set of permissions for their application, not because the application necessarily needs it, but just because it makes their life easier?
Yeah, so that's a good question. We haven't had a lot of applications that ask for maximal privileges. All privilege requests are within this a manifest file, a manifest.xml file, and we tend to parse those regularly and generate statistics on them, and we haven't seen that occurring very often. I think it's important that we minimize the amount of permissions they ask for, and we're hoping that users will start flagging these applications as being either as concerned with them. So maybe not flagging wouldn't be an appropriate term. They could make comments and say, like, why does this Pac-Man game require access to my contacts, access to the internet, access to my dialer?
Right.
And that would definitely be a signal to trigger if we think something is malware or not.
And on a related question, in terms of the UI that comes up to users and kind of informs them of what permissions the application is requesting, you know, a risk is that, you know, those will get long and it'll be like the end user agreements that no one reads and people just click accept.
Yes.
And then they give their life away, that kind of stuff. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so what we do is we only show the highest risk permissions, mm-hmm. and hopefully that will scare the people enough. But for instance, this Twitter application requires more permissions, and we have this little show all button for people to see more if they want to investigate the other permissions it requires.
Right.
So we only show the critical permissions, and then we hide the lesser privileges for people who are concerned about that. But yeah, we agree that I totally agree with you that if this extends too much, people are going to become complacent.
Right.
So it's much better to just send them a few to try and trigger their attention rather than bombard them with every permission. We'll get a better answer, even if we don't provide as much information.
All right, and we'll take one final question from Gary.
Hi, Gary McGraw. I have a question about the bug pile or the exploit pile. So you showed us some of the exploits and problems that were discovered externally.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, there's a whole bunch that were discovered internally.
Oh yeah,
and there's some division between design problems and stupid bugs. Can you give us some feeling for the percentages of in those categories?
We found significantly more bugs internally than externally.
Like order of magnitude.
Orders of magnitude.
Yeah,
like a few orders of magnitude.
And how about design problems versus just stupid bugs?
We did have a lot of design problems. One issue that comes to mind is this storage mechanism we call content providers. I didn't mention this, but it's another fundamental object within an Android application. is to have these things called content providers. All the contacts are within content providers. We want to allow both read or write access to the content providers. But these content providers accept SQL requests. So even if you're doing a kind of a write request, you can gather side channel information for the read requests. Or you could gather side channel information and gather some information from that database. And so we found some issues with respect to that. And we found, what other design issues? That's a good question, actually. We found a few design issues with respect to our intents, because our intents are kind of like URL protocol handlers, and we're very afraid that people would hijack intents, and how we could minimize people hijacking intents while allowing for multiple applications to accept intents. That turned into, we actually decided in the end to query users if we have many intents. I wish I prepared more for that question, because maybe we should even talk offline, because I think we could talk about some really interesting problems that we had during design, and I bet that would be very insightful for other people designing new solutions in the future.
Okay, once again, let's thank Rich for coming out. Mm-hmm.